Advertising your business with GCN is simple, effective,
and more affordable than you might think.
Visit advertise.gcnlive.com for more info. Take your business to the next level.
You can stick it to the man and big tech. Join our FTL social mastodon at social.freetalklive.com.
Talk Live. Welcome to the program here. As always, you're invited if you want to join the show. You can bring up anything you want. The number is 603-283-6160. That's 603-283-6160. Here in the studio tonight, it's Ian.
And Aria.
We also have remotely Mark. Go ahead, Mark.
Here I am.
All right, careful on that mic. It was a little bit hot there, Mark, but
Eager to be on the show with us tonight.
He is very eager because we have a different Mark on the line with us as well, and he is Mark Hopkins, a.k.a. Dr. Bitcoin, also known as Rizzn, R-I-Z-Z-N. That's his Twitter handle. And we have said a lot about your situation in the last most of a year, Mark. Welcome to Free Talk Live. It's good to have you here.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
Yeah. You're out of prison somewhat at this point.
Yes.
We're going to talk about why you went into prison. It's something that's going to ring very close to Aria and I, who are both Aria currently right now sentenced to 18 months in a federal, presumably minimum security camp-style prison.
Well, of the three that the judge suggested, they were all minimum security. One of them is a medical facility. I don't know why that one was even brought up, except that it's the closest one, I'm guessing. So, but yes, all minimum security from what I can tell.
Now, Aria, you took a plea in the Crypto 6 case for the unlicensed money transmission charge, if I recall correctly.
Operating an unlicensed money transmitting business, yep.
And is that my recollection, Mark? Is that what you went in for as well?
18 U.S.C. 1960, yes.
Yep.
That's
it.
Same one.
I think the difference, though, between you two was that Aria violated this, allegedly, right, violated the section that has to do with the federal permission slip, and the feds went after you, Mark Hopkins, for not having a state permission slip. Isn't that right?
Well, it was initially not having the federal permission slip.
I got
backwardly compliant. I mean, like they're retroactively compliant, which is you have like a 6-month forgiveness window to get compliant. And then they were very specific about how even though I was federally compliant, I was not compliant at the state level.
Take us back further to your story. As I understand it, you are an old school Bitcoiner. You're one of the OGs. You discovered Bitcoin back in the day, probably sometime around when we found it here on Free Talk Live. We had a caller call into our show in late 2011 to turn us on to it. And of course, we were skeptical. You know, when we first heard about it, we ended up having Gavin Andreessen, who was a listener and a supporter of Free Talk Live, because he was one of the original programmers that Satoshi passed the sort of the keys, if you will, over to before Satoshi disappeared. And he came up here from Amherst, Mass., which is just down the road from Keene, New Hampshire, where we live, and met with Mark and I at a local Thai restaurant. And I think he paid Mark, I don't know how many dozens of Bitcoin for the meal. 42 Bitcoin.
46.
Yeah.
Sorry.
For the meal. And, you know, we asked him all the questions we could cook up, because at that time we were still pretty skeptical. And I heard your interview on Joel Valenzuela's podcast, Mark, and I think you had kind of a similar getting started story. Why don't you take us back?
Yeah, very similar. As I said to Joel, it was very ironic that the person who got me involved into Bitcoin was a vice president at Bank of America at the time. But it was somebody that I had been childhood friends with.
Is he still at Bank of America, or did he do something else?
I'm fairly certain he's moved on to another corporate gig. I shouldn't say more because he has chosen. He's a very paranoid about his
fair enough.
His identity. He doesn't even carry a cell phone. He uses a flip phone just so he won't be leaking data or whatever.
Good for him.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, real smart. But yeah, we just started reconnecting and hanging out like we did when we were kids at a coffee shop late at night. And one night he brings up this thing called Bitcoin, and he's, you know, trying to describe it to me, and I'm not quite getting all the, what it is that it's about. And he's like, you know, I tell you what, I mean, like a good nerd, I had my little, clamshell laptop, with me at the time. He goes, you got a laptop, just install a client, and I'll pay you, for half the dinner tonight in Bitcoin. So you have something to pay with, play with. And then you just pay in cash for the rest of dinner. So I got about, $12 in Bitcoin when Bitcoin was about $12.
Okay.
A coin. Yeah.
Right.
7 to 12, somewhere in there. So that was what I first got to play with. And then he and I went back and forth. I think I had a grand total of like 10 or 12 Bitcoin over the years of just things that I paid for that he paid me in Bitcoin for.
Did you get your first Bitcoin at $12?
Yeah, it was between $7 and $12. I recall that range because it was right when it went from 7 to 13. And I remember thinking, wow, this is great. I'm making a lot of money just in this first 2 weeks of me playing with this thing. So,
mm-hmm.
You know what I like to call those people is Johnny Come Lately.
Yeah.
So did you dig in pretty deep at that point? Did you start to, you know, really research Bitcoin and learn about it?
Well, I mean, what I recall, and we were talking about the kind of the advent of podcasting during the streaming days, which we were also both around for. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I first discovered podcasting, it was the same kind of gut reaction that I had when I discovered Bitcoin. It's like, dude, there's already technology that does this. We have PayPal. Like, what's the point of this? Like, we don't need another payment mechanism on the internet. And it took me, I would say a good week or two to wrap my brain around what made it special and what made it work. But then, you know, it's been down the rabbit hole ever since.
Yeah. At what point did you become Dr. Bitcoin?
So I feel like I still to this day feel the name is ostentatious, but it was just a thing. I used to work at SiliconANGLE, which is enterprise technology publications, big in the enterprise tech space. And I was the Bitcoin guy on staff trying to tell everybody else we need to be covering this. And so we needed a name for the column that I wrote, and one of my staff, Kit Dotson, suggested Dr. Bitcoin. Okay. Or maybe responded to me jokingly suggesting, he goes, no, that's good. We're going to go with that. I'm like,
yep.
Okay, sure. But,
it,
you know.
It is good.
Yeah. I mean, the feds thought so.
They locked up Dr. Bitcoin.
Yeah. They like that stuff. So at some point, you decided you were going to start selling Bitcoin online through, I presume it was localbitcoins.com, the big location for these things?
So I don't recall if Local Bitcoins was the first place I sold it. Probably it was, because they're pretty old. They might have been around when I first started, but I remember I did a bunch of meetups through Craigslist as well. Because,
oh, wow. Okay.
Like, aside from NT Gox, there really wasn't a great place to just be the center for finding Bitcoiners. And of course, we all know the NT Gox story at this point.
Yeah, the first cryptocurrency exchange that ended up going down, and lots of people lost their bitcoins, and who knows, you know, what the real story was behind all that. But so you were actually meeting people in real life. People, you're going to like McDonald's or someplace and actually trading cash for crypto.
Yeah, and so again, this is during my SiliconANGLE days, and SiliconANGLE was co-officing with another podcast outfit called Livid Lobster, which is Callie Lewis and Geekbeat TV. They were kind of big in the early days of podcasting, and still continue to produce stuff to this day. But fortunately, I had a really neat location like this one. It's a big, you know, expensive studio, and so I would actually have people come to the office because it's was set up to have meetups and be kind of a public meeting space, but also had some sort of geek cred going with it as well. I never hid who I was when I did these things.
Right. But because you didn't think you were doing anything wrong, right?
Right. And for years, the feds didn't care.
Yeah. And when did you start doing the online sales, and when did they stop you?
So, I mean, like I said, I didn't start and try 2011, 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And primarily as two reasons. One, as a way to meet other Bitcoiners, and two, as a way to kind of keep a finger on the pulse of who is in the Bitcoin space. Like, what does the average customer look like? So I can write about them. So I can talk about the adoption curve. It transformed into something of a business where I was focused on making money. Around 2019, around the advent of the pandemic, And then the feds started caring, in my field of vision at least, around 2020, which is when the raid occurred, the end of 2020.
What was that like for you? If you don't mind talking about it, I know it sucks.
I mean, it's not great.
No, it's it never is.
I'll say, I mean, just being like bare and emotional about it, like it was a traumatic moment. Like I haven't seen a psychiatrist about it, but I think I have the symptoms of PTSD starting from then, and other factors contributed to it over the intervening years. So, yeah.
Was it a pre-dawn raid?
Was set up a pre-dawn. Actually, so the interesting breakdown of that day was they picked up, because it was one of the client in question was a cash by mail client. Not, I don't have a ton of those, but I had two or three, mm-hmm. and she was one of them. And they had delivered a package, or they'd intercepted a package that she had sent, and had put a ream of printer paper instead of cash.
Mm-hmm.
So I picked up the box and we opened it up and there's no money in it. So we're like, oh, we got robbed. Like mm-hmm. somebody at UPS or FedEx said, this is money in here and we're going to switch it out. And, you know, this was always one of the risks of doing that. And sure. we were always upfront about that with the clients. Like, if this happens, this is not a thing we're going to assume risk for. And they're like, okay, that's fine. We understand the risk.
But it was the FBI that intercepted the money and replaced it.
That is correct. And so I had other places to be. And so after that happened, I conversed with the client and let her know what was going on. But I had to go to another meeting on the other side of town. So the raid actually happened in between that moment and me being like about 30 miles away, basically going to a bank and another Bitcoin meet and doing another transaction.
Just to clarify, they raided your home while you weren't there?
While I wasn't there. They 15 agents with AR-15s and, you know, flak jackets on and all that mess.
Was your family there?
My family was there, kids, my three dogs. You know, lucky they came out of it alive, the dogs, because we all know like what they like to do with pets a lot of times. And one of them's a fairly big, you know, bull mastiff. So
did they not realize that you weren't there? Because that's a pretty major screw up on their part. Like, they do a lot of recon on people before they raid their properties.
So they couldn't get the warrant until I opened the box. So they took the evidence of me opening that box directly to a judge to get a warrant. I have a timeline of this whole thing broken down, like minute to minute. And so they got the warrant within 45 minutes, but I was gone within 30.
I
wouldn't say it's my, it sounds presumptuous to call it my trauma. I don't like saying it because I don't, whatever. But like my trauma, I guess, was dealing with the stress of not knowing, like my communication stopped with my family.
Right.
Like, because they stopped answering the phone because they took the phones away while I'm, you know, breaking speed laws to get back to my house to figure out what's going on.
What alerted you, I mean, you're away from the home. What alerted you initially to something was happening?
My wife called me while she's trying to close the door on the FBI, and they're sticking their foot in the door saying, the FBI is here.
Oh, my God.
And I'm like, what? what advice do I give you in the 30 seconds that you have to listen? So I gave her, like, a couple words, and that was, yeah.
Oh, my God. All right, so then you come home. They're waiting for you. They put you in handcuffs, take you to jail. What happened?
Frankly, no. I was never arrested. I was never indicted. It was I felt up through the end of that day that this was a giant mix-up that I could talk my way out of. And it felt like it because it seemed like I talked my way out of it. They all left my house.
Well, they do that on purpose to get you to talk. They make you feel like you're making progress, and you might talk your way out of it to keep you talking, to keep you confessing, and ultimately to use all of that stuff against you.
You're absolutely correct. You're absolutely correct. I mean, like, I've done a lot of consulting with different government bureaucracies over the years, during the ICO years. SEC and FDIC and the Fed were all knocking on my door. I did several speeches at the local Dallas Fed. So I felt like I had a handle on talking to government officials, and it was a foolish mistake on my part. I should have just waited for a lawyer.
Mm.
Because it's obviously a different situation. I was a target, not a consultant.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, I don't know that it would have mattered. I'm not saying you did anything wrong, because God only knows what they were going to do anyway. But generally, it may not have affected you, but generally, people probably should just not talk to the FBI.
How long was it?
Let me ask you that question, though, is what do you feel? Do you feel that the information that you said did ultimately sink you or not?
They probably would have been able to make the same case that they ultimately made with publicly available statements that I have made. And it was not hard to prove that I was a Bitcoin seller. It's just that because I was cooperating and saying, look, I've done nothing wrong, I'm an honest businessman, all they needed to do was look at the spreadsheet that I gave them of transactions that I did that I thought that was going to exonerate me and my client, because I had no idea she was involved in anything untoward. I said, like, look, we're doing a legitimate business here. Here's the transaction list. And then, like, cool. Guess what we're going to use as evidence against you.
Right.
So, like, they would have found other evidence, likely, but I handed it to them on a silver platter. Yeah.
So the client, it sounds like the client might have been involved in some untoward business. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, and this is all public information. You can Google her with enough digging, but the name is Mildred Hoy. She is a 50-something-year-old woman from Pennsylvania. She represented herself as trying to buy Bitcoin for her husband's electronics business because they kept getting bank accounts shut down when they did international wires to China.
Okay.
And so, which is
legit.
I mean, I've had other clients with that exact same story that I personally verified. She gave me her ID. She gave me her social. She verified a phone number. She took pictures with the ID. She did all the things you're supposed to do when you're verifying. I had no reason to suspect she was lying about anything.
But she was.
Oh, clearly, yeah. So we stopped communication shortly after the raid. So everything I know comes from her Pacer record after that. But what is in her...
But they charged her?
Yeah, they charged her with all the same... No, without, not 18 U.S.C. 1960, but for wire fraud and mail fraud.
Mm. And so they actually found a scammer. Is that what you're saying?
No, they did not.
I was really hoping for them. I was really rooting for the FBI that they might finally, after all these decades, really find an actual scammer. Instead of going to the gun store and arresting the gun clerk for selling a gun to a murderer, that they might actually find the murderer themselves. That they might find a person who's had a victim. But no, they have to keep on dragging people in to pretend like they do work that benefits the American people. They have to keep dragging in these innocent folks.
Well, this is exactly what happened here. So as it turns out, she had been, according to pre-sentence report, I've not spoken with her, but she was being catfished by a Nigerian and being, I would say, emotionally manipulated. She was not a hyper-intelligent woman. And that's not like kind of a knock. She just was, she's always struck me as just a crypto unsavvy person. All of her questions were very beginner, which is also part of the reason why I like doing Bitcoin sales. I like explaining stuff to people. I like bringing people into crypto. Mm-hmm. So none of that really raised a red flag either, because somebody who was a scammer, somebody who was involved in some Nigerian lottery scam, as the FBI alleged in her case, would have to be more sophisticated about the ways and means to accomplish it, in my mind, which is why, again, no red flags. But she was being manipulated by somebody who knew the system much better than she did overseas, who also saw no repercussions for any of his involvement in her actions in this matter.
So he was taking advantage of her. She was buying Bitcoin from you, lying to you to get you to make the sales. And then the FBI came in and said, and how did they use this against you specifically?
I mean, what they did was, and they actually came and gave her a warning, according to the court documents, and said, you need to stop this or we're going to charge you. And she kept doing it. And then that's when they moved in on both of us within a couple of days of each other.
So they arrested, she's a scam victim.
Mm-hmm.
They arrested and charged her for being a victim?
Yes. Yes, she was up for a possible 20 years. The judge said, this is insane, but we have to give you something. So she was sentenced with 18 months.
18? For being a victim?
Yes.
18 months in prison?
For not stopping when they told her to stop, it sounds like.
Yes.
Well, I'm not convinced she was doing anything illegal, unwise, perhaps. But
she probably believed this guy's story,
yeah.
Right?
And yeah, absolutely. She wouldn't have done it otherwise.
She probably went to, my guess is,
so she got
the threat from the FBI, and she went to the person she thought was her lover or whatever the scam was, and she said to the scammer, this is what happened. I don't believe this. Tell me this isn't true. And he probably says, well, no, of course it's not true. And then convinced her to keep doing what she was doing. And so she probably still innocently went along with this, not realizing the potential consequences. That's my guess.
I just don't understand. It's crazy because they made this entire big stink when they were prosecuting me and arguing for me to get the maximum sentence, that it was all because of people like her being victimized by scammers. But at the same time, they're going after these victims and putting them in prison?
Oh, I suspect multiple people in my case, because I did go to trial. Some of the people who testified, I suspect they were under threat.
Well, we know at least one was. Well, I know at least one was.
I don't know if we know that they were, but I suspect they were also under threat. If you don't testify, we're going to bring charges.
Well, I mean, that's ultimately what they did with me, because they were threatening to charge not just me with conspiracy on the charges she was up against, which again carried a max penalty of 20-25 years, depending on how it sliced.
Mm-hmm.
If it was served concurrent or consecutive.
Was this conspiracy to money launder?
Conspiracy on all the charges that Mildred had, which is money laundering, mail fraud, wire fraud.
Okay.
And then they were also leveraging my wife on that as well, because my wife shared a bank account. And so in the proffer meeting, which I try not to talk about too many of the details of, but in the proffer meeting, one of the things I said is, look, whatever deal you're planning on offering me, you know, I fence this through my lawyer in much more diplomatic terms, like whatever deal you're trying to offer me, it's a non-starter if my wife is on the table. And so they did agree to give my wife's lawyer a letter of no prosecution based on me taking a plea deal, agreeing to take a plea deal.
Good chivalrous bastards that they are. They let your wife go free so long as they can convict someone of something so that it looks like they're doing something about scam artists while they're grabbing up little old ladies who've been fooled by Nigerian princes and good Bitcoin geeks who are selling them the Bitcoin that they're asking for. You know, the Nigerian princes continue to gallop on. Well, at the very least, they didn't go after the Bitcoin geek's wife. You know what? I feel better about my government already.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too. I'm feeling all patriotic also.
Right.
Yeah.
I feel like the FA-18 should just fly overhead and we should all stand for a minute while they play the national anthem for all the FBI agents who have fallen in the line of duty, grabbing up little old ladies and charging them with fraud.
And apparently sending them to prison for 18 months. Mark, stand by with us. I know we have you for the full hour. We're going to definitely keep you for that full hour here. So more with Mark Hopkins. He is not quite out of the federal system yet. He's still in essentially the halfway house. We'll talk more about him checking into prison coming up here in moments. It's Free Talk Live.
Silver has always been nature's very own antibiotic, and only one system allows you to generate an endless supply of natural silver solutions. SilverLungs.com. You'll find no wild claims or pseudoscience, just a lifetime of nano-sized pure silver solutions. The Silver Lungs generator allows you to make your own, so stop paying for silver solutions. The unique lung delivery system targets respiratory infections where other silver solutions simply cannot reach. See the Silver Lungs generator and lung delivery system at SilverLungs.com. That's SilverLungs.com.
As Dr. Wallach says, we all have nutrient deficiencies in our diets and must supplement with 90 essential nutrients in proper balances. At no cost or obligation, get a personal certified holistic health coach to help you develop a supplement program based on Dr. Wallach's recommendations. Call Linda at 833-VITAL-90. That number to call is 833-848-2590. That's 833-VITAL-90.
USA News Update. House and Senate leaders are going to meet with President Biden next week to discuss the debt limit. The U.S. could default as soon as June 1st if the debt ceiling's not raised.
It is Congress's constitutional obligation to act.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said President Biden wants a clean bill to raise the debt limit and won't negotiate. But House Speaker Kevin McCarthy said the debt limit will not be raised without spending cuts. More troops are being sent to the southern border ahead of the expiration of Title 42 next week. The Biden administration is sending 1,500 active duty troops in anticipation of an influx of illegal immigrants. Former President Trump says he may skip at least one of the first few Republican presidential primary debates. Trump is either skipping the first debate in August in Milwaukee or the second at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in California. Last week he bragged he was skipping debates because of his lead in the polls. John Schaefer, USA News.
Get healthy, not high, with 100% pure CBD powerful natural pain relief from Veterans Vitality. GCN listeners, have you ever thought about how CBD may help you? I'm sure you have heard about the many benefits of CBD. Well, here's your opportunity to try before you buy. Created by veterans and for everyone who deserves better choices, our CBD is derived from organic hemp, grown in the USA, and third-party tested. Veterans Vitality CBD saves you as much as 25 to 50% over our competition, and a portion of all sales is contributed to veteran nonprofits and events. Many of our customers have experienced improved quality of life, help with anxiety, PTSD, and overall well-being. Our products do not contain THC. They are safe, non-addictive, effective, and 100% legal. GCN listeners, get your free trial bottle of premium CBD by simply paying shipping and handling at GCNFreeCBD.com. That's GCNFreeCBD.com. Again, GCNFreeCBD.com. Offered by Veterans Vitality Premium CBD.
I had no idea it would destroy my life. But before it happened, I had a successful business in Austin, Texas. Everyone laughed at me when I shut that business down, but I could not ignore the wake-up call. I was volunteering on a project to get locally grown food into a school. That project was a complete failure, and I discovered that there were few local farmers. There's only 4 days' worth of food in the grocery stores, and everything comes 1,500 miles via a just-in-time trucking system. I lost friends and family who told me I was crazy to worry about that, but I kept at it. I'm Marjorie Wildcraft. Those of us who know what's going on in the world know you need to become self-reliant before the dollar collapses. I've created a free webinar at gcnfood.com. I can show you, like I've shown hundreds of thousands of people, how to grow lots of food, even if you have no experience, you're older, or you're out of shape. Do it now, before the stores are boarded up and food is not available at any price. Go to gcnfood.com. gcnfood.com.
Appreciate what we do? Help us advertise, market, and promote for just $5 a month at amp.freetalklive.com.
It's Free Talk Live, and you can join the show here, although if you are going to be calling in this hour, you should have a question for Dr. Bitcoin. His name is Mark Hopkins, and he is within the federal so-called justice system, Bureau of Prisons, after having served several months in an actual federal prison. He's now at a what is equivalent of a halfway house. We'll talk more about that experience here in a moment. He was just expressing to us the story of getting into Bitcoin and ultimately selling Bitcoin to people online and selling to people in real life. And then the federal government raided his home. Because, well, it turns out one of his clients, and I think you pointed out previously, Mark, that you had, what, hundreds of buyers over the years?
I mean, like in that neighborhood. I mean, yeah, not all of them were of major volume, but hundreds of clients, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, but turned out that at least one of them was being victimized by an online scammer. And they targeted that lady, and they targeted you. They raided your house with your, you know, your wife and your kids and your dogs at home. Thankfully, they survived the raid. And then they came after you with various different charges and told you they were to come after your wife as well. You managed to cut a deal to where they would only convict you of one count, I believe, in return for your guilty plea and keep your wife out of it. That kind of brings us up to speed.
That's a good recap.
All right. So I do want to say thanks real fast to Chris, who is a Free Talk Live supporter of our AMPS program. AMPS stands for Advertise, Market, Promote, and Support. If you appreciate this show and you want to get behind what we do here, then you can join, as Chris has done, over at amps.freetalklive.com. That takes you over to our Patreon. And he did it for $5 a month, and that's all we ask. So we definitely appreciate the support. You get some perks. You get some benefits. Once again, that's amps.freetalklive.com. To follow Dr. Bitcoin, you can follow him on his Substack account, which is Ask Doctor, spelled out, Doctor, AskDoctorBitcoin.substack.com. It looks like you're doing a weekly newsletter.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, what do you cover?
I mean, it's the same thing that I've been covering since I started doing Ask Dr. Bitcoin. It's how-tos, it's news. I find myself in the last year and a half really covering what I'm umbrella term calling the struggle, which is the state versus crypto and blockchain.
The jihad.
Yeah.
Yeah, a little bit something like that, yeah.
Definitely. Well, glad you're out there doing that. Did you see that your profile risen in the last year since the attack by the federal government? That's how you came across my radar recently. Was last year. I just happened to see somebody sharing your posts on Twitter about how you were about ready to check into federal prison, and you had a really lengthy series of tweets about kind of the history there, and you brought me to my attention, and I didn't see a whole lot of coverage in the crypto media, but it did seem like you got some of it.
I got a good smattering of it, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, so like I'm always been like the new media guy's new media guy. I'm regionally famous at best for my crypto activity. I've ran in the early social media, early adopter Web 2.0 circles, as I talked about with you before we got on the air. I've done podcasting before podcasting was cool, and streaming radio and all that kind of stuff. I would never be what I would term as famous, but media people know who I am. In within my industry, right? Yeah. Within my sector of coverage. So I didn't really expect to go mainstream. I mean, like all the major crime beat reporters that cover stuff that just like reprint whatever the DOJ says covered my case.
Mm-hmm.
But I was really lucky to get some good coverage from Guy Malone and over at Bitcoin Magazine and a smattering of YouTubers that just caught it in the, cause I didn't promote it. Very heavily before I went in. I think I only gave the world like a 4-day warning before I turned myself in. So,
and it's a little embarrassing, right? Like, you know, I'm going to jail, everybody. It's going to be 4 days and then I'm going to jail. And that's not a fun thing to say.
I don't find it embarrassing though. Right. Like, yeah. I don't.
It is and it's not. And I don't know. I don't know if you're at this point in your journey yet, or maybe you are. You've passed this because you've been very public with your stuff. They had me on a gag order throughout my case. They
really?
Multiple times threatened to pull my plea deal if I talked publicly about
Whoa.
Anything. So
why did you decide to speak before turning yourself in? Was the order?
Because the sentencing was the end of that order. They no longer had anything else. I thought at the time they had nothing else they could throw at me. They made my time at the BOP a little bit more difficult than it should have been.
Because how did they do that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to get too far into that because I'm still in BOP custody and they can still make things a little worse.
Okay. All right.
But whenever you're inside of and the BOP is this, I have no compunction saying this, is a banana republic dictatorship.
Mm-hmm.
Their BOP is barely answerable to the DOJ, which is barely answerable to the federal government.
Right.
So anything they want to do while you're in is what they're going to do. It's not even like an evil thing. It's just whatever occurs to them as the most convenient, easy, or profitable thing for the individual members of the BOP to do is what they're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's exactly true. And I was trying to share that sort of inside knowledge with Aria recently is that because it seems very much like the things that the DOJ say at this time are highly relevant. But in all honesty, once you get on that Bluebird bus and that diesel engine starts up, brum, brum, it's all the BOP, the Bureau of Prisons, I should say.
Correct. Yes. Yeah, they are an entity unto themselves.
Yeah, very little accountability. I mean, you can complain to the warden, and you know, there's not much that is going to happen. And this isn't
like
just
your
a Bureau
judge.
Of Prisons thing. It isn't just a Bureau of Prisons thing. This is just, you know, state prison, federal. There's just very little. Very little accountability. They didn't have you. I mean, if you can't answer, it's fine. They didn't have you in a CMU, right? Communications Management Unit.
No, they did not.
Because you were still tweeting. You had some family members on the outside that were taking tweets and posting them for you.
Right. Yeah. I spent a good 3-4 weeks setting up Zapier automation so that I could manage some level of communication through core links to various my Telegram, my Discord, and my kid, so he could manage my Twitter account. And you know, over time, I found
less arcane ways of communicating with the family and still getting stuff out. Like, they don't monitor outgoing mail. So you can write whatever you want in a letter as long as you're not on some kind of a watch list, and they won't monitor your outgoing mail.
I'm surprised about that.
They'll monitor your incoming, though.
So Aria's going to be checking in for her 18-month unscheduled vacation here. You had, I think...
Oh, it's quite scheduled at this point.
Well, yeah. Unplanned. Let's call it unplanned.
For sure.
You had, what, with a 15-month sentence, Mark?
15, yes.
Uh-huh. And so did you have a check-in date where, you know, they didn't take you right from court, right? They gave you a little bit of time?
Yeah, they gave me a month to get my affairs in order and self-surrender.
How far do you have to travel to get to the prison from where you are?
It's about a 7 or 8 hour drive from Dallas to Beaumont. So,
did you leave your car there? Like, how'd you do it?
So, I mean, my wife is always up for a good escape, state, you know, vacation. So we rented an Airbnb on the outskirts of beautiful Beaumont, Texas, and stayed there for a few days. And then she just dropped me off.
Mm.
And then
got it.
Came back and picked me up a few months later.
Seems like a terrible place to leave a car.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't do it. You can't leave your car. No. They won't let you.
7 months, you told me offline, was how long you were actually at this facility on this 15-month sentence now. As I understand it, federal time, good time rule is it 80 or 85%?
It kind of depends on the math skills of the person that does your paperwork, but it's supposed to be 85%.
Okay.
The joke there is that, like, so they do counts, you know, where they count the number of prisoners, and the joke is that you can't work at the BOP if you're able to count because they screw it up 100 times a day.
Oh, my God.
Like, you can't count 125 because that was the number of people in the unit. They always messed up the count.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So how do they determine this stuff? I mean, you obviously 7 months is less than 85%. How does this all get calculated?
So we do have the Trump administration to thank for somewhat smaller of a sentence because we have this thing called the First Step Act, which is an improvement on a previous piece of legislation called the Second Chance Act, which allows you to participate in what they call programming and earn time off of your sentence in that way. For your first year, the max you're able to earn for every day that you're programming is 10 days for every 30 that you program.
Okay.
After your first year, you can earn up to 15 days for every 30 for a max of 1 year off your sentence. In addition to that, 6 months before your out date, which is modified by all your credits, your 15% off and your FSA credits, 6 to 9 months, depending on a lot of factors, you will qualify to go to either a halfway house or home confinement based on the whims of a lot of people.
So based on that, yeah, I'm probably looking at about 7 months inside myself, it sounds like, assuming I do all the FSA stuff?
I would assume so, yes. They would, the Mildred, who was sentenced on an East Coast facility because of her location in Pennsylvania, I believe she served somewhere between 5 and 7 months. And basically anybody that's got a year and a day or... between a year and a day and 18 months ends up being inside for between 6 and 7 months.
Hmm. Okay.
Well,
I have a question too. Yep, and indeed, I find this news heartening and I'm glad to hear it.
Not the word I would use, but I'm glad you're happy.
Well, it's better than it was a moment ago. I have a question of plea bargaining. So, and this is going to be a tough question. You may not have ever thought about this, but I've spent a lot of time thinking about plea bargaining throughout the 20 years that Free Talk Live's been on the air. And I think that plea bargaining itself ought to be outlawed. I mean, I know you, as a libertarian, you're not supposed to say outlawed, but
sure.
This is government limiting itself. And let me make my case, if I may, briefly. If we can look at the different groups of people that are serviced by plea bargaining, I would say that plea bargaining benefits the bureaucrats that are supposed to be taking people to trial, giving people a fair trial as guaranteed by the Constitution of the United States. So those people would be prosecutors and their concomitant, bureaucracies. It benefits the prison guards because they are able to significantly grow the prison complex because of plea bargaining. I would suggest that there would probably be about 20% of the people in prison that are currently there, but that a much larger percentage of them would be guilty of a crime with a victim. It benefits evil criminals, these people that commit crime and do bad things, because they, they've got the, they're able to plead down to a lower charge. They're able to go to prison for something less than what they've done. They get a lower sentence for than what they would get. I can't speak to how the sentences would look in a world where we didn't have plea bargains. Maybe they would be lower too. I just don't know. I can't speak to that. But
I think we can though. I think we can speak. I think we can speak to a world without plea bargains, because we had a world before plea bargain prevalence, and sentences were not nearly as long as they are now, right? So you can say that this has been a tool to lengthen the stay of people in prison, because if you fight, they pile on punitive charges. And this was the case. I mean, this was evidence in my case, evidence with the cases.
This is why they argued for me to have the max versus everyone else,
because you didn't take the first plea. Yeah.
And it's also like I can go down and Ari, you're going to meet a ton of people. Just like I did. I mean, you're going to be in a minimum security facility, which means there's no child molesters, there's no sexual offenders, there's no violent criminals. You're going to meet so many people, the majority of which had their life screwed over by the federal government for doing what is basically made up crimes.
Oh, I know, man. I'm going to find.
What is conspiracy, but like being physically adjacent to a crime? What is money laundering but exercising financial privacy? What is, trafficking and...
The fun thing is we actually got the judge in my case to admit that money laundering and financial privacy were somewhat related, and that the prosecutors were arguing that I was turning a willful blind eye toward money laundering, and my attorney and I pointed out that no, it's because I believe in financial privacy, and that was one of the reasons I found value in Bitcoin in the first place. And the judge actually accepted that argument. He did ultimately say that he didn't care whether it was money laundering or not, but he did appreciate and agree that I was coming at it from a matter of financial privacy.
Which makes you, by definition, a political prisoner, which makes any Bitcoiner under the law, sentenced under this law, a political prisoner, because we all got into this because we believe in financial privacy.
Right. In fact, in my case, because I did go to trial, the prosecutors believe, now obviously we don't know what the jury was thinking when they convicted me, because in our argument when we're going to appeal is that they never actually proved their case, but essentially the prosecutors made some innuendo that because I spoke publicly and had it like in my local Bitcoin's profile that I respect people's privacy, even though I was certainly going through Know Your Customer procedures and getting identification from people, but that I care about people's privacy. Just simply the fact that I advertised that I cared about privacy, they say, meant that I was inviting criminals to do business with me. That was their argument.
That's bait.
Their argument was that privacy is a criminal act.
I mean, what the prosecutor told me, the Sid Modi, the U.S. attorney that prosecuted my case, he says, whenever he pulled me into the proffer meeting, he said, look, we know everyone in your book of business is a criminal. and we want to know everything about everybody. And, you know, it just so happened that I don't know what everybody does in the private time, but most of my clientele was like family offices, lawyers, and, you know, above board businesses. So I had no problem talking about any of my clientele, saying, look, these guys are not doing anything wrong, but, you know, investing in Bitcoin. But that is the general opinion of the
federal. But Sid said they were criminals. And you know what? And Sid is right. I just want to make the, you know, step down for a second. Sid is right. Oh. Everything is illegal. I mean, there's a sufficient number of things. At this point, a little old lady can't buy Bitcoin for a Nigerian prince without going to prison for 7 months. You're damn right. Everything is illegal.
I'm not sure that's the example we should use, but
yeah.
I understand where you're coming from.
Just saying, everything's illegal.
Yes.
Poor lady.
Were you
she
the only
got ripped off?
Were you the only Bitcoiner in the minimum security facility, or did you encounter any others?
Actually, this is an interesting factoid. I didn't realize it at the time, and I'd like to compare timelines with you guys, because there was a sweep the same week that I was raided. There were two other people, two other 18 U.S.C. 1960
inmates in the facility that were also swept the same exact week. And then another person who we all know the name of, who was the same week as all of us, was John McAfee, was raided overseas the same week as us.
I think they came after you earlier than us. Ours was March of 2021.
No, this would have been October of, 2020. Right.
They could have raided, they could have arrested me in 2018 when they were investigating me. They went and they talked to my ex-girlfriend and her fiancé at the time, and they certainly had enough to, you know, bring me up on whatever money transmission charges, maybe a few more. But no, they waited 3 more years so they could stack as many charges as they possibly could stack.
Well, plus in October of 2020, that we were way too high profile for them to have bothered with, right? I mean, at the time, we were going internationally. We were getting international news coverage. Arresting us at that time would have been an obvious political hit, and it would not have ended well for them.
Well, they're trying to serve the American people, and they want to stop crime. I mean, that's what they are, right? They're law enforcement. They want to make sure crime doesn't occur. So they arrest people as quickly as they can. They would never wait 5 freaking years and allow crime upon crime upon crime to stack upon each other and victims to be continued to be victimized.
No, that's exactly what they did.
Somebody might bring that up in court and say, hey, look, maybe the perpetrators here are as much the prosecution as it is the Nigerian princes.
They actually admitted, Mark, in the FBI agent who was in charge of the case admitted under cross-examination that she, in her 24 years of working in this particular area, has never caught a single scam artist. Not one. And in fact, a couple of the elderly victims of these scam artists admitted under cross-examination that the FBI never even asked them a single question about the scam artist. There was one guy who sent over $1.2 million of his retirement funds away to a scammer. About 200 to I think close to 300,000 came into some of the accounts that I was working with. So there was another $900,000 that this guy sent away of his money to somewhere else, and he said they never even asked him about the $900,000. Can you believe that?
Shockingly, yes, I can believe that. One of the reasons I think, and maybe in my that I didn't think that this was going to be as big of a deal as it turned out to be, was because I've had issues where the FBI has been called about like an embezzlement that has taken place at a company that I've worked for. Mm-hmm. And like one that I worked for back in 2006-ish or so, a bad actor in position to do so embezzled about $2 million away from the startup that I was at. And we all interviewed with the FBI, and they deemed it was below the threshold of capital embezzled for them to investigate. And so I'm thinking, oh, well, I only sold Mildred about $500,000 worth of Bitcoin. This can't possibly be something that they're going to say, okay, this is something we must investigate further. But surprise.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I called the FBI to try to handle someone who had threatened both on and off the air publicly to harm me and my 7-year-old, started at 7 and went over the course of years because the FBI wouldn't do anything, my 7-year-old son. And this was, by the way, I called them the same week that they were going after the Ben Shapiro. They went after the guy that threatened his family, and they still can refuse to do anything. Now, I'm of the opinion that's because they have a vendetta against Ian, and my email address is similar to his. But, you know, I don't know why it is that they decided that it was fine that a 7-year-old boy be killed in a fire as threatened by this person, but they did, because in my opinion, they're not out there being the good guys. In my opinion, they just get on these little vendettas, and that's what they do.
I mean, this is really what people talk about when they say that there's like systemic racism and systemic classism, is because the system is set up to do this. This is not a misappropriation of justice. This is the justice system doing what it was set up to do, which is to protect credentialed elites, whether those be bankers, politicians, or other types of credentialed elites. This is the system doing what it's supposed to do. We are the aberration, and it is trying to correct it.
Yeah, they're definitely protecting the bankers. There's no doubt about that.
I mean, the FinCEN is completely staffed by banking, they wrote all the memos against digital virtual convertible currencies.
Yeah. Yep. And still, to this day, as I understand it, Congress has yet to pass a single law in regards to regulating cryptocurrency. So what we have is all these different government agencies, from the SEC to the FBI to FinCEN to the CFTC, bringing all these cases against people in the crypto industry, whether it be peer-to-peer sellers being targeted criminally, whether it's the SEC targeting Bitcoin exchanges and developers like Library with just destructive civil cases, the CFTC just now bringing a civil case against Binance. It's like, they all have different opinions about what Bitcoin is. One of them says it's a commodity. The other one says it's a, you know, it might be a security. Another one says that it's property. I mean, they don't know what it is, but they're just taking whatever's convenient for their purposes to put more people behind bars and to destroy more more innovation and more business. It's really frustrating.
It really is. I think it's part of a larger, right? I mean, this is playing into a larger, populist theme of anti-innovation, that's been building up for some time. It's the same mindset and memes that you've been seeing against NFTs, against AI, against, Silicon Valley, you know, just this whole, you know, it's being lumped in together. I mean, I think we talked about with Joel, Elizabeth Warren feels comfortable running on a platform of establishing an anti-crypto army.
Yeah.
Someone who supposedly built her career on being a banking reformer is against cryptocurrency.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, explain this.
Oh, it just shows her true colors. You know?
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, at this point, she's a politician beholden to her stakeholders, and her stakeholders are, you know, being a part of the establishment, and bankers are part of that establishment.
Absolutely. Mark, thank you for joining us here tonight. I definitely appreciate your time with us. How much more time do you have in the halfway house before you're totally out of there?
I am currently, my exit date is July 30th.
All right. Well, I hope everything goes smoothly for you, and feel free if there's any developments you want to share with us. We'd love to have you back on to talk about anything.
Yeah, come quickly.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you, man. Really appreciate you spending time. And again, folks can visit you at your Substack. It's AskDoctorBitcoin.substack.com. He's at Rizzen, RIZZN, on Twitter. And we got hour number two coming up. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
No matter where you live, what you make, or who you voted for, there are some things that will impact all of us soon. Whether you're concerned about the alarming increase in man-made disasters, financial institutions collapsing, or worsening food shortages, Americans are preparing in numbers not seen since World War II. What's changed is how we prepare. And the folks at My Patriot Supply have made it easier than ever for you to have peace of mind, knowing you're ready for what's next. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com and stock up on over a dozen emergency food kits. These include tasty breakfasts, lunches, dinners, drinks, fruits, veggies, meats, and snacks, averaging over 2,000 calories per day. Get at least one kit per person. As we all know, calories equals energy equals survival. My Patriot Supply food kits are in stock and shipped discreetly. We've seen too many Americans let down by institutions we used to trust. It's time to rely on ourselves. MyPatriotSupply.com. MyPatriotSupply.com.
You don't sit behind a desk every day to earn a living. You're out and about making it happen. And sometimes you get a little bit behind on your paperwork, you know, like bookkeeping and paying your taxes. It's easy to get behind on paying your taxes. It happens to the best of us. And you know what happens next. The big bad IRS comes knocking on your door. And when that happens, you need to call the good old boys at the Tax Doctor. Let them do what they do best. Deal and negotiate with the IRS so you pay the lowest you can in back taxes that the law allows. We are a 100% U.S.-based company, and we've saved our clients millions over the years in back taxes. If you owe $10,000 or more in back taxes, call my friends right now at the Tax Doctor and learn more.
800-507-3137. 800-507-3137. 800-507-3137. That's 800-507-3137.